after you've gone and left me crying. After you've gone, there ain't no denying. Oh, you'll feel blue. Oh, you'll feel sad. La, da, da, da. Do we have time to waste on this ridiculous theme song tonight, huh? I mean, things are so short and time is so fleeting. Cut it off. After you've gone and left me crying. Oh, that moon is hanging over Manhattan. And the ganglia are quivering. You can almost feel the passion surging against the traffic on 6th Avenue tonight. And while they're still hanging on the straps, and while they're still quivering, Mario, hit the money button quick. Get them quick.
Here's Stan Getz and Astro Gilberto for McLean's.
It's McLean's, the toothpaste that cleans with a new kind of taste that's wild. What a taste, what a thing. When you smile, all the bells will ring. Get them white, start tonight with McLean's. Taste the difference, try new McLean's, you go.
You still using that sweet kid stuff? Try the new toothpaste that gets teeth irresistibly white. You can actually feel McLean's whitening. Your whole mouth feels refreshed and invigorated.
Get them white. Start tonight with McLean's. Taste the difference. Try new McLean's, you go. Taste the difference. Try new McLean's, you go.
That's great, Scott. Hip toothpaste now. Stay away from that sweet kid stuff. This toothpaste tastes like bitter gall. For those of you who are really hippies, kind of a sweet, gloppy taste. I don't know what that was all about. You know, it sounded great, but I don't know. You know, that moon hanging down. And since I've just come back from a trip to the Antipodes, do you think we ought to hit another commercial here before we get started? I don't want to bust up one of these magnificent moments of mood creativity by winging one at you. But do you think we should? All set? Oh, yeah. Somehow, the idea of Stan Getz on a toothpaste commercial, it's things have come to a pretty pass. Speaking of pretty passes, go ahead there, Dad.
Is your car old enough to smoke? Surprising how many cars are. Is your car old enough to smoke? Surprising how many cars are.
A car needn't be old to smoke. Some cars start burning oil early. If your car uses too much oil, give it Prestone Oil Miser. Prestone Oil Miser is just what the name says. A miser for oil. Prestone Oil Miser stops oil burning, restores lost power, quiets noisy engines, cuts exhaust smoking. Prestone Oil Miser makes worn engines run quieter. Just add a can of Prestone Oil Miser to your regular oil. Insist on Prestone Oil Miser, wherever auto supplies are sold.
If your car's old enough to smoke,
surprising how many cars are.
If your car's old enough to smoke,
get Prestone Oil Miser.
That's wiser by far.
Prestone Oil Miser is a product of Union Carbide.
You know, I must admit a terrible thing, that I'm so glad to be back that even the commercials sound good. That's an awful thing. You don't realize how American you are, I'll tell you. It's funny, I receive hundreds of letters every day from people, every time I make a trip, from the non-travelers, people who have never really traveled much in their lives, and who have fantastic imaginations about what traveling is like. I mean, really big-time traveling. I don't mean taking a trip to Pittsburgh. I mean traveling, Dad. And they have these great romantic concepts. That, oh, I suspect it's the Richard Halliburton syndrome. Is very strong among people. Even they believe that the traveling in itself is a romantic thing. And yet, I'm not so sure that that's true in this day of the jet. It's a very curious thing that the unreality that begins to slowly build up in you as you travel over one country after the other, and you're in the same jet, you know, And all jet planes, no matter what the aircraft, no matter what airlines it is, no matter what country you're in, they are the same. Now, I have done traveling in Europe where I took the train. I would travel for a while on a German train, and then I would make a change, and I would be in a French train. Then I would make a change, and I would be in a Belgian train or a Dutch train. And you don't have a sense of unreality then. You have a sense that you're really traveling in real countries, that there are real people walking around there, and guys blowing their noses and scratching. And, you know, that you can look out, and there's dirt in the streets and cigar butts and beer cans, and there are different beer cans in different countries, and the writing is different on the walls. But when you travel in a jet plane 12,000 miles and more, you begin to feel that the whole world is kind of a toy. Yeah, it's kind of a, not really is it a toy, it's a dream, and it's an illusion. And I'm sitting in a plane 30,000 feet above Pakistan. Now, the reason I'm thinking about Pakistan at this moment is because of the moon that's hanging over New York tonight. If you'll just take a moment and look out of the window, you'll see this is a fantastic night. It is a full moon night. And believe me, it's the kind of night where all kinds of drastic mistakes are made. Murders are committed and all sorts of things cook, you know. It's just a fact. It's one of those spring nights. But I was sitting in a plane. The hostess is going up and down the aisle. This is a hostess. They change hostesses and they change crews in such disparate places as Calcutta. A new crew will come on. They got on at Frankfurt. Now they're getting off at Calcutta. You lose that crew, and the captain says, "We are leaving you here. The crew here under Captain von Schlagenheimer with his crew are bidding you good afternoon and hope that you will have a pleasant journey as you continue. Please keep your seatbelts fastened until the plane comes to a complete halt. Thank you." Well, next thing you know, there's a new crew. And they take over at, say, a place like Calcutta. And they will carry you on to a place like Singapore or Darwin. Can you imagine how the world must be to people who work in international jet planes? Now, don't say, wow, it must be exciting. You know what it is? Unbelievably D-U-double-L. That's the surprising thing about it, which always confuses people who think that the concept of being on the move itself is exciting. This is an American idea. That's why the Americans are the restless breed today. They travel from one end of the country, turnpike traveling, constantly on the itch to go, to move, because the idea of movement excites Americans. Just to be going is enough. That's the reason itself. And you come into contact with people to whom movement is deadening. Quite the opposite of what the Americans think it is. I talked to a hostess, a stewardess on an international plane who has been in 150 countries like in the past 5 years. She's been a hostess for 5-6 years. And she had a peculiar, a kind of stunned look about her. And we were sitting in a plane. It was a half-empty plane, as a matter of fact. That's why we got talking. And I said to her, you know, she was in Tokyo last week, and the day before that, she'd been in Cairo for a day, and a couple of days before that, she'd been in a place like Bangkok, and she's going to be in Shanghai and Hong Kong and all. And I said, "Gee, you know, this is a fantastic thing." And she says, "No," she said, "just once, I'd like to be in a place, really be in a place. There is nothing more boring than to be uninvolved. I think boredom stems from that." And I don't think the average person who has not traveled a great deal knows much about the great slices of boredom that exist in the travel world. In fact, one of my friends whose profession is traveling, who writes a great deal, in fact, writes for Playboy, about all over the world. He's in one place one month and someplace else the next month. I remember one time sitting with him in a coffee shop down in the village. And he had just come back from a year in Africa and India. And they were sitting there. And I had just come back from Beirut or someplace, maybe Nigeria. And we're both sitting there drinking iced coffee and looking out on the scene. Everybody's walking back and forth. And I said, gee, isn't it great to be able to read a sign? Just look over there and you can read what it says, like room for rent. It says, no loitering, commit no nuisances in this alley, that kind of stuff. Isn't it great to know that they're not saying sneaky things about you, and you can read it, you know, there it is. And he says, yeah, man, yeah, wow. He looks out, and about 10 minutes later, people come up, you know, and they say, gee, it must be exciting. Once in a while, somebody recognizes you and say, wow, you just got back from Nigeria. And I say, yeah, very exciting. And somebody says to him, you just got back from India. Yeah, very exciting. And this went out for about 10 minutes, and finally I said to him, I said, Shell, I said, 90% of the time, isn't it a fantastic drag to be traveling? I mean, really? And he says, oh, man, wow. He says, wow, you're walking out in the rain and nobody gives a damn. Isn't it the truth? Well, looking at this moon tonight, I'm riding along on my little motorcycle on 6th Avenue, and there's that moon hanging out over 34th Street. And I was immediately struck by an image of a moon. I was flying at about 36 or 37,000 feet above Pakistan. And there was a moon that must have been 17,000 miles across. And it was an absolutely, completely clear night. There was not a cloud in the sky. In fact, I doubt whether there was even a bird in the air for miles around. And we are flying over Pakistan. We have just left Karachi and we're hanging up there. Nothing is moving. You know, when you're that high in a jet plane, there's not even a sense of movement. And you can see the earth. You know, not often at that altitude can you see. There you could see Pakistan down below you there in that brilliant moonlight. And the pilot came on and he said, the air temperature at the altitude we're flying is 70 degrees below zero. He said, it is 70 degrees below zero. The ground temperature at this moment is 97 degrees. And they were entering their hot, rainy season. See, it's about 95, 97 degrees down there. And I'm looking down on Pakistan. And the moon is kind of hanging off the port wing, glancing off those Rolls-Royce engines. And the stewardess is moving up and down the aisle. Two or three people are asleep. And I'm looking out of the window. And everybody in the plane has been traveling now since Middle Europa. And the idea of being in a jet plane is no longer exciting. The idea of being over an exotic land is no longer exciting. Let me tell you about flying over the Greek islands at dawn. This is an experience. Which I will have to tell you on a later show. But going over, flying high over Pakistan with the moon hanging above there and the girl going up and down the aisle trying to ply people with something to eat. You know, you eat almost continuously on a transcontinental air flight. They're constantly stuffing candy in you or beer or champagne. You know, you wake up in the morning with a martini in your hand. You don't even drink martinis, you know. And you find yourself at 7 o'clock in the morning, somebody's giving you a wet washcloth, hot washcloth, and you wipe your face, and you slowly come to, and the next thing you know, you got your hand, in your hand is a half bottle of champagne. Now, where did this come from? I don't know. You're drinking, you know, and your stomach is gurgling, and you're flying out over someplace like Indonesia or Borneo, and you're drinking champagne. I don't know what the... It's, you know, there's a... No wonder most... people who write novels today write out of the novel of the absurd, because there is a peculiar kind of absurdity involved in flying in this fantastic luxury over a land like Pakistan. And I'm reading an old copy of the overseas edition of the Herald Tribune. You know, I'm clinging to every little piece of English writing I can cling to. You know, you get to this point where you want to read something. You want to read something that makes sense to you and talks about home. And I'm reading an old copy of the Herald Trib. And on the front page, they're discussing the Pakistan, you know, this big problem between Pakistan and India, the borderline war state that now exists in that area of the country, that area of the world. And I'm reading this piece, And the hostess is trying to give me a bottle of beer, and I'm looking out of the plane window at the same time, and the guy next to me is asleep and sort of falling down under the seat there, and we're piled high with airline bags, and there's that funny smell of a jet plane, and I'm looking out, and here's the moon hanging over Pakistan, and I'm looking at Pakistan, and I'm reading the Herald Tribune's report on the war in Pakistan. The Pakistani ambassador is making this statement, and the head of the government is making that statement, and the head of the Indian government is saying this, and they're talking about the military preparations in Karachi. We have just left Karachi. I've just left Karachi about 5 minutes before, and I'm looking down the fantastic moon, and I had to keep saying to myself, that is Pakistan. Look down there. That's Pakistan. And sure enough, it was Pakistan, rolling kind of gray and silver down there. You could see an occasional little cluster of lights, very dim lights. You know, you begin to judge your countries when you fly internationally over great distances by the intensity of the lights. That at 30,000 feet or 35,000, almost all countries look the same unless they're fantastically mountainous. And so the only thing you can judge them by is how the lights look. And so if you fly over, let's say, Germany at 35,000 feet, the lights have a certain intensity, and there is a certain, I don't mean the lights themselves are bright, but there is a certain intensity of numbers that you can see clumps of lights, and you can see little skeins of highways going off in the distance, but you don't in Pakistan. You can look out over Pakistan, the whole horizon. I don't know how many hundreds of miles your eye must be able to see at 38,000 feet. It must be fantastic. Maybe it's 500 miles. I don't know. And you see way off in the distance two little tiny yellow lights. And then down below you, you see one little light, and it sort of flickers. And that's Pakistan. And it's hot down there, and you're flying over it, and you say, gee, they're on the verge of a war down there. And here we are, flying at this fantastic altitude, and the moon is laying off over our port wing, and the stewardess is going up and down, would you have some beer, please? Would you have some beer, please? Speaking of beer, hit the button, Mario, will you please? Miller High Life. Oh, the champagne of bottled beer is recognized everywhere. You know that I had a German talk to me about what a great beer Miller High Life is in the Frankfurt airport. I'm drinking this German beer, and he says, oh, but when I go to the United States, yeah, I drink Miller High Life. That's a good beer. So if you're looking for a good beer to wrap yourself around, I would suggest Miller High Life, brewed for centuries in an old, musty, dank European castle, and now they've cleaned the whole scene up. And during 1965, Miller High Life celebrates its 110th anniversary in America, brewed in the same old stick-in-the-mud tradition that's made Miller High Life famous the world over for good beer. Cut it, Mario. That's very good. Speaking of stick-in-the-muds, this is WOR, AM and FM, New York. I couldn't help it. We have a policy of stick-in-the-mud. You're a stick-in-the-mud station. But do you want to hear more about my travels? Well, that's part of it, this unreality thing. And, of course, every once in a while, you are hit not only by the unreality of space and jet travel, but then suddenly you are hit by the reality of a country itself. It almost overwhelms you because to most of us, this is a side of people, me. I'm talking about me. It's a side of everybody that has always intrigued me, both as, you know, just a person walking around and a performer and a writer, whatever you might call it. I've always wondered about that interesting concept of the abstract that we have. In other words, the abstraction that man is capable of. All the other animals, as far as we know, don't do this. That it is impossible for a turtle, for example, as far as we know, to conceive of another place. As simple as that. He knows only the sand upon which he is. Now, does he know that that sand is attached to an island, that is attached to some water, that is attached to a continent? No, he doesn't see this. Does he? Has he got a concept of the moon, of the sky? Well, we can do this, you know. This is the thing. This is the great thing about mankind. It also makes us probably the most dangerous creature in the face of the globe, because we will fight only over abstractions. Very few battles are ever fought over realities. We will fight over words like peace. We will go to war for peace. We will fight over over words like democracy. We will fight over words like freedom and dignity and all these. These are all abstractions, interesting abstractions. Does a shark have an idea of dignity? Isn't it about that dignity of the individual business? I don't know, you know. This is mad. You know? And one of the things that I have always been intrigued about and by, in myself, I'm not talking about you, I'm talking about me, is how I conceive of a country or a land, which is an abstraction, believe me. Australia is an abstraction to those of you who have never been there. It has to be. It's a thing you've heard about. And you have an image in your mind. You do. You obviously do. You have to. That's what's the resolution of an abstraction involves that. So if I say to you, just come out of the blue, if I say to you, Singapore, all right, you've heard of Singapore. You know about Singapore somehow. What do you think of Singapore? How do you see it? Interesting thought. Is it like the way? No, I can guarantee you. Almost every traveler who is a world traveler has been, at the very beginning of his travels, struck by two things. One, the wild disparity between what is and what he has abstracted. And he's also struck by the thing that the country that he's visiting is at the same time both more interesting and wildly divergent from what he thought it was, and at the same time less. In short, you are constantly struck by the fact that these are real countries, and you can be bored in real countries, you know. You walk around New York City and you're often, your mind isn't working. You're dull. You know, you're just walking around. The sun shines down. You go in and out of the chalk. You can't even remember last Wednesday. Well, we think oftentimes, being people of abstractions, being a restless breed, we think that if we go to Rome, that will happen. That Rome, since it is an abstraction, has no slivers of reality in it. You walk around Rome and you never think in terms of you got a bad cold and your eyes hurt in Rome. And furthermore, there are guys who shove you in the elbow in Rome, you know, and you don't get a bus seat in the bus in Rome. You never think about these things, that you get blisters on your hand from carrying your bag, and the weather is bad. A lot of things which don't enter in abstraction. So when I say to you, Australia, what is it? Well, it ain't what you think. That's all I've got to say. It just is not. It's both far more interesting and far less interesting at one and the same time. Now, I learned years ago as a traveler, try to erase your mind before you go anywhere. Try as hard as you can. Try to go there with like a blank piece of film. So many people, you know, steep themselves in the country that they're about to visit before they go. They'll read book after book, and they'll look at pictures, and they'll get out maps and all this jazz. And I have rarely found people who do this to be other than very conventional travelers, and quite often bored and disappointed travelers. Found them that way. They'll have books, guidebooks, and all that stuff. And you keep saying, Charlie, quit looking at the book. Look out there. See that? See that big slob there in the corner? Who's being sick behind the Pepsi-Cola sign there? That's a Greek. Look at him. See, that's a real one. He ain't in the book there. You know? And they don't do it. They will not. They just won't, because it's so much easier to go back to the guidebook, because the guidebook somehow precipitates and, in a way, augments the abstraction. Well, I am in a plane, and I'm coming down into Australia, and I've tried to close my mind to what it's going to be like. Well, the minute we left, of course, we left Darwin. I landed at Darwin. Darwin, we came into in the middle of the night. spooky place. And the next couple of weeks later, I came back there in the middle of the afternoon, and I found it was even spookier than I had thought. I mean, at 2 in the morning, it was spooky enough. And we took off again, and all that night, we flew over the fabled Australian desert, the outback, which you have heard about, and which, by the way, does not look like anything you think of. Everyone thinks, wouldn't it be exciting to go to the outback? Wouldn't it be fantastically exciting? Well, you might as well stand yourself right in the middle of a Kansas plain that somehow has been decimated by fire and has been baked by an insane sun for 50,000 years, and that would be roughly the outback. Very roughly, but that would be sort of the way the outback. So it isn't very exciting. It's infinitely depressing. And so as we were winging over that, and we're getting closer and closer to Sydney, and the sun is beginning to edge up, I was beginning to get excited, sort of. Two kinds of excitement. The first one, gee whiz, wow, Sydney, you know. And the second one is, gee, I hope it isn't a drag. I hope it's worth coming for. Well, just as we were hitting the dawn, we began to approach Sydney Harbor. And the plane made a great, vast left turn out over the sea, and down below you can see those fingers of the coast and the unbelievable Sydney Harbor reaching out like some great hand. And it was still vaguely dark down there on the ground. You know, where we were, it was light. It was bright. The sun was coming up. Brilliant sun. And you could see the sand down below. Those long, narrow, everywhere you look on the Australian coastline, you see this brilliant white sand. It's as though the whole continent, is it an island? Is it a continent? There's always been a lot of arguments about that. I think they call it a continent now, don't they? There's this long, lacy edge of white sand with the rolling surf coming in. This is the surfer's paradise, believe me. If you can walk between the sharks, you're all right. It's magnificent. You see those rolling combers coming in, and right in the middle of it is this jewel of a city, Sydney, on this indescribable harbor. Well, we came down lower and lower, and the plane swooped in over the city, and I'm looking down. It's all hills. I never thought of it as hills, you know. That's the first thing that hit me. And we're coming down lower and lower, and now I can see the tops of the houses. And the houses don't look like Queens, by the way. It doesn't look like Queens. And I'm not putting Queens down, because Queens is very interesting from the air when you come in after having traveled all over the world. That it looks something like Queens in a way, because the houses are very dense. The density of houses is there. But you begin to see strange things like palm trees. You know, you're just not used to this. Palm trees down there. Big trees with great, great red blossoms. And you see this coming lower and lower and lower. And you see people walking on the streets. And that's the first sign. That's a real Sydney, Australia down there. You know, we're coming. Nobody's looking up, nothing. The plane is whistling in. You know, you always expect everyone to be looking up. You know, showbiz, here I come. You know, nothing. They're just going around. You see cars coming down. And the next instant, we're coming down on the Sydney airport. And we swoop in. It's a beautiful airport, by the way. And it's all sun-drenched and very flat. We lay down and he makes this landing. We have traveled all the way across Australia now, which is roughly about the distance between New York and Vancouver, or maybe New York and way down and up in San Francisco someplace. It's about the size of America. She lays down, and the door opens, and I'm out in Sydney now. Brisk, clear, brilliant air. And these people, these red-faced guys, everywhere you walk around in Sydney, you see red-faced people. Their faces are all bright red from two things, the sun and gin. it's a drinking country, I might point out. And you know, another thing, I've got to tell you a lot of things about Australia that probably you don't know. For one thing, they're maniacal about censorship. Did I mention that last night? About, you know, I write for Playboy, see? Well, Playboy is banned in Australia. Well, I arrived in Australia, and immediately one of the local columnists discovered a Playboy writer was in town, see? And he called me and said, oh, I say, chap, you write for Playboy, don't you? And I said, I indeed do. He said, well, you realize, of course, you chaps are banned out here in Sydney, you know? And I said, I know, I'm perfectly aware of that. He said, well, of course, you know, it's a ridiculous situation. Everybody's laughing about it, you know, but you are banned, you know. What do you intend to do about it? I said, well, look, don't say anything. But I have brought in my luggage, hidden way down near the bottom where all my underwear and the soap is. I've got a copy of the May issue of Playboy. It's an advanced copy, and I've got it hidden in a copy of the Christian Science Monitor, you see. And I looked very pious when the guy there at the gate there was looking at the luggage, you know, and he was looking very sternly at everybody's bags. And the guy right ahead of me had a copy of all things confiscated right there in front of me, a copy of all books, Mary McCarthy's The Group. Yeah, they took it away. This guy's, what do you mean? And the American guy's got, I'm sorry, sir, this book is not stamped. Here's a receipt for it. You can get it on the way out. And they put it in the thing there. And they had taken this book. Now, I can see them censoring it on literary grounds. It's a very dull piece of nothing, you know. But they were censoring it on other grounds. You see, they didn't want that book. And, oh, for crying out, Mary McCarthy's The Group. What is this? Well, I immediately thought that I was going to be, you know, in the slam with my copy of Playboy there. See, so I stood there and looked very serious when he looked at my, let's see, Christian Science Monitor. Is that on the list? No. He went on down. Underwear? No, that's okay. It depends on the kind of underwear. And he stamped them all up now. And there I was, you know, I was in Australia with a contraband copy of this magazine. So I, here was the guy on the phone. I arrived in my hotel. I wasn't there 10 minutes, and this columnist was on the phone. I never heard of him before. How he knew I was there, I don't know. And he said, what are you going to do about it, chap? I said, well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I think I'm going to go down. I said, I passed a coffee shop on the way right down here by the hotel, a coffee shop called the Wimpy Burger Palace. Now, I passed the Wimpy Burger Palace, and they've got outdoor tables there, see? And I'm going to sit at high noon there at the Wimpy Burger Palace, and I'm going to unfold my copy of the Christian Science Monitor. I'm going to order myself a double Wimpy Burger. I said, I'll play it real racy. I'll order a double Wimpy Burger and some iced coffee. I'll play it right to the hilt. Iced coffee. And then I will spring out my copy of Playboy, and ostentatiously I will unfold the centerfold out at high noon and sit there in front of the fuzz and, you know, say, oh, wow, Miss May, oh, wow, oh, wow. He said, really? And I said, yes. He said, by George, when do you intend doing this? He was taking me serious. I said, well, I will be there at high noon on Monday. Well, I had no intention of going at high noon on Monday and reading Playboy at the Wimpy Burger Palace on Pitt Street in Sydney. But I'll tell you this, I found out later that he was there with two photographers and the chief of police. So I almost precipitated an international row. Now, you didn't know that about Australia, did you? Well, now, on the other hand, they have very strict drinking laws. Oh, they're absolutely maniacal about their drinking laws. And so what happens? Well, I'll tell you what happens. They close the bars. You know, they have these gigantic bars. You never saw anything like it on every corner. And they're only for men. Women are not allowed in these places. Absolutely not. And they're all tile. And they are huge. They're about like the size of Madison Square Garden, each one of them. Yeah, I've never seen anything like this anywhere in the world. And on the outside of each one of them, they have these wild, strange, peculiar pop art 1920 sort of advertisement drawings. You know, with the collar-ad type man. Have you these 1920 drawings? A collar-ad guy with the lady with the long evening gown and with the big moon hanging over it. All these taverns have these wild drawings on the outside. It shows a guy playing tennis, and he looks like a 1922 tennis player, you know, with the long white pants and everything, and the sun is shining, and he's hitting a backhand. And above it, it says, for true good sportsmanship, McGregor's beer. All over the outside of these things. And, of course, immediately after work, they're jam-packed with guys, and they're lapping it up. Because it closes at 6. And so immediately after 6, at 6:05, the streets are paved with drunks. What a country. I'll tell you, it's a nutty place. It's not only down under, it's upside down under. Everything is slightly out of focus. You know, you get down and you think, well, you know, they're just like Americans. Well, they aren't. This friend of mine keeps saying that I was traveling with, he says, you know, the thing that the only thing they share with the English is they have a vague English accent. Vaguely English accent. Outside of that, oh, they hate the English. Oh, they're always yelling about the English. And they love Americans. And they love American television shows. And they like to think they're like Americans. And yet, they're like... I keep thinking of stories I've read of... you know the phrase, Big Butter and Egg Man? Did you ever hear that phrase? Of the big-time spender who wears the jazzy sport coat, you know, and he's got the two-tone slacks, and he's got a big tie and a straw skimmer, and he's got a Marmon raceabout, and he's got three chorus girls from the Goldwyn Follies, and he's taking them all to Atlantic City for the big weekend, you know, and they're drinking champagne out of the slippers. That's the way I felt all the men in Australia were that I met. They're kind of big-time Charlies. And loud, you never saw a louder crowd. I'm in a party, you know, and it's, being an American, generally you feel, when you travel around the world, you generally have a feeling of a vague cultural inferiority. You know, you really do. You go to an English party and there's a certain inness, a certain behavior, and you feel kind of clunky, like a clod when you're an American. You know, you're just sort of, yeah, you're there. And, well, yeah, it's kind of a good time I'm having, you know, that kind of stuff. Well, this was the first time where I felt very, very genteel. I felt very genteel. I felt very cultivated and cultured. I'm from the home office, you know. I'm from where they created Naked City, you know. I'm from the home of Ben Casey, you see. I'm from where Dr. Kildare originated. Yeah, me and Elvis, we're, you know, we come from the same root stock, that kind of thing. So these guys are standing around, and here is the curious part of it. These red-faced, heavy-drinking people are, at the same time, the most formal crowd I've ever been in my life. I am there 2 hours, and I get invited to a party. Well, I figure, you know, an Australian party, gee, that must be something. Everybody, informality, it's a frontier country, and there's only 11 million people in this country, and there's a room 55 million, and the outback, and the kangaroos, and the wallabies, and all that stuff. I figured, you know, it'd be a kind of a swinging thing. And so I'm a traveler, you see. You're an air traveler. You don't carry dinner jackets with you. You don't carry patent leather shoes. I don't even own a dinner jacket, you know, with the striped pants and all that stuff, with a little maroon tie and the stiff shirt and all that. So all I've got is a white shirt. I figured, well, it's a party. I think maybe I'll dress up. Dress up, you know. I've been feeling kind of crummy in the plane. You get how is it that you can get cinders in an airplane in your ears? I mean, have you noticed that? You get cinders and you get crud on your face, just like when you were in a train, you know, with the windows open and the smoke flying. And I'm feeling kind of crummy, so I take a bath. And I said, well, I'm going to get all dressed up. I put on my white shirt, you know, and my paisley tie, the one with the crawdads on it, you know, and I tie this all up, and I put on my sport jacket, and I, you know, a fairly clean pair of slacks, and I buff off my shoes, and I get a cab, and I go to this place where the Australians are having their party. Their party, by the way, starts at 6. Now that I figured, you know, must be very informal. You know, at 6 o'clock, they sit around, they have a couple of hot dogs. Let me tell you, I arrived at this incredible home that was built on the side of a hill, and really part of a hill. It was a California cliff house, you know, 5 levels like that with a spiral staircase that ran up in the middle. It was made out of granite stone and had lights and the trees and the palm trees hanging around. And out in front of this place are all these cars all lined up. A Bentley, a couple of Rolls Royces. There's a Jaguar, big, long Mark 10 Jaguar, and a couple of Rovers, and the whole scene. I said, gee, whiz, wow. And I could see the Japanese lanterns up there, and I could hear polite tittering laughter. And I start up this long stone staircase, and I'm met by the butler. The butler. And he says, good evening, sir. May I take your, you know, there I am with my, you know, may I take your shoes? What? I didn't have a coat or anything. So I'm just an American. I, you know. And he said, oh, yes, of course. Come right and follow me. And up we go to the staircase, and the next instant, I am in the middle of a Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers party. right out of the movies. You know, the late movies when you see these very posh parties that always have guys like C. Aubrey Smith wearing their medals and all that stuff, you know. And Ginger Rogers is there with a long gown with sparkly things in her hair, you know. Fred Astaire's got a cane with the ivory head and all that stuff. These guys, they're here. I'm surrounded by 50 guys wearing the true formal evening dress. I mean, the real thing. They even had their decorations and all with the ribbons down the front and a stiff shirt. And they got red faces. I mean, real loud, yelling, hollering, fist fighting, red faces. And they're all dressed up. And the ladies are all 9 feet tall and they're wearing sparkly things. And I walk in the middle of this, and here I'm feeling real, real short and rotten and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And I said, Bruce, I said, wow, you know, you should have told me that this is a formal party. And he said, oh, actually, old chap, this is not a formal party. We're just having a few cocktails. It's just a few cocktails. What happens when you have a formal party? He said, oh, well, that's next Sunday, and you're invited. And they're serving little shrimp with little ivory holders and stuff, and I'm standing there, and they're making polite chatter. And this was Australia. It's a strange country of true contradictions. And what are they talking about? Now, you would think a crowd like that would be discussing the latest novel. They would be talking about Edward Albee. Oh, no. I'm right in the middle of a group. I figure, well, you know, I might as well go in, get in the cold water. I'll plunge right in. What the heck? I'm here, you know. They can't get mad at me. So I get in the middle of the group, and this guy, one guy's saying, I say, should have bashed him a cosh on the side of the head. I say to him, that damn referee, I don't know where he has. They're all yelling about some idiotic football game, but in the most slobbish terms. You know, a cosh on the side of the head. I say to him, I say, oh, knock it off, you idiot. And they're talking about, well, I realize. I realize here's another contradiction. Let's get on with a few of these commercials, man, or we won't be here to tell about it. What is this? For heaven's sakes, another warehouse sale of luxury vinyls. Hey, by the way, this was such a fantastic success the last time they had it on the show, a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month or two ago, that they are repeating this thing again. And if you missed it the first time, you better make the scene. These are luxury vinyls for upholstering and wall covering, and really top-flight stuff. The Vinyl Fabrics Division of Leather Guild, Incorporated, invites the public to come in direct to the Leather Guild warehouse for tremendous bargains and odds and ends. If you've been looking for something to upholster a pad or use as wall covering, and it's too expensive, get down there. These are odds and ends, closeouts, and discontinued patterns in the finest vinyls made anywhere in the world. Now, this is the Leather Guild Warehouse at 52 East 21st Street. They ordinarily deal only with the big-time decorators and that. And this is for the public. It's at 52 East 21st Street, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. And this is savings of 40 to 50% off the warehouse prices. Again, it's Leather Guild, Inc., and the address is 52 East 21. Yeah? All right? Oh, I'll tell you. And tomorrow, yeah, just remind me. No, I'll do that tomorrow night. We'll do the happiness spot tomorrow night. For those of you who are missing my announcement about the happiness people, the restaurant up on Broadway, we'll do it tomorrow night. So you just be calm. One thing I want to tell you, tomorrow night I'm going to do a show about leaving Sydney early in the morning in a flying boat for a South Sea island called Lord Howe Island, a little tiny bit of coral, a coral atoll, a little itsy-bitsy coral rock in the middle of the Tasman Sea. And I will tell you about that and other sundry exotic experiences. Oh, man. Do you want to hear about all of them? Well, you're going to be bored. Nothing happened. I just sat there, chewed on my fingernails. No, I'll tell you all about it tomorrow. Be careful. That moon is hanging over Manhattan. That's a dangerous thing. Reconsider, fella. Just think it over, okay?